Hello, hello. Welcome back to the CTO studio. I, of course, am your host, Nikolai Walker, on the mic and in your ear and saluting you. We are back again today, and we are doing another interview with Aaron Longwell, who is the Director of Engineering, Justice Sector Support Program, Afghanistan. So he is building the app that hosts all of the Afghanistan legal system, and we are going to do the deep, deep dive today and get into the nuts and bolts, or meat and potatoes, if you're vegetarian, for how this exactly is being built. So I'm going to hand it off to Etienne and let's get started.
Yeah, so you move into a new role where someone says to you, we're going to a country to help build the legal back end to the whole country. And you're like, okay, this sounds awesome. Let's do this.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, you get what you ask for kind of thing. I had, when I was planning to leave Culture Foundry, I was sort of like, had some career aspirations. I had always been kind of a freelancer or worked on small teams. I'd worked with a lot of big corporations, but had never worked in one. And so I was like, I feel like I have a weakness in terms of the way I was wording it for a long time was indirect influence. Like when I'm not just like in charge of my five developers on my team, getting like other parts of the organization to move the way I think they need to move through influence and persuasion, I was like, I'm not good at that. I have never done it. And the only way to do that was to go join a bigger company. And so that was my intention. And then kind of out of the blue, this project came along and it was so interesting and intriguing. I started spending time with it and thinking about it. And then I kind of realized indirectly that it was the most extreme version of that that I was looking for, because it's like, I have so little power on this project. I'm, you know, relatively low ranking in the State Department world, but, you know, if I can effectively communicate and if I can, you know, make persuasive arguments, things that I think should happen will happen. And I've had a ton of opportunity to do that. So that's kind of why I took the project. But in retrospect, it does look very crazy because it's like, this is an enormous project. To fill the listeners in. So what we're building is, we're building version 2 of a system that was built originally 8 years ago. It was originally built just to track the results of criminal trials in Afghanistan. So it was basically a court and prison administration system so that they would know, okay, how many people are in prison for this? How many people are in prison for this? And the main reason the U.S. Was funding it was it's the department of the State Department called International Narcotics and Law, which essentially exists to support legal systems in other countries as a way to minimize impacts of crime that becomes international. So, you know, things like drug trafficking, human trafficking, terrorism, if they can get just and effective legal systems operating in countries like Afghanistan, then, you know, the problem is dealt with locally, essentially. So that's kind of what was the basis of the original project. But over time, they realized that a big weakness of Afghanistan was that the courts are corrupt and ineffective, that people, you know, don't get good justice when they, file a criminal complaint or when they have a lawsuit. So in a lot of places, you know, people would just not use the court system, or they end up having to bribe judges to get what they want. And so they expanded it to do what's called case flow management, which is essentially a kind of a business process reengineering idea of how you make a court system run more effectively. So the system we're building basically starts at the moment a crime occurs or a lawsuit is filed, and it manages it through the investigation phase, through court procedures, through appeals processes, and through the Supreme Court, and ultimately manages basically the prison population of who's in what facility and for how long. There's an enormous number of moving parts. There's dozens of different ministries of the government that we work with that all have to work together on this same piece of software. So there's governance boards that the project we're on has set up to get the different ministries to work together. I've since become aware that this is one of the only systems in the world that works this way. Like the US would have a completely different procedure for the police, another procedure for the local prosecution, and probably multiple for them. And the court would have its own system, and then the prisons would have their own system. So there's huge advantages from a software perspective to do it this way, but there's huge political challenges to get all these ministries working together. You know, it's like it's a requirements gathering nightmare when you try to figure out how to make all these things operate the same. So when I came in, one of the very first things I did was try to take a strategy of building kind of a decoupled monolith. So we essentially are treating each ministry as its own module in the software and very tightly controlling how they exchange data with the other modules. So we can almost behave, we can almost treat them as independent units, even though they do ultimately have to agree on certain things with how the software works. So that's the gist of what I've been up to. I think the last time we talked was 2 years ago, and I was what's called an STTA, short-term technical advisor at that time. We've since turned it into a 30-month contract, and we're about 14 months into that, basically halfway. So yeah, it's been fascinating new chapter in my career. It's been a lot of learning, a lot of challenge. It's great.
And so I'm assuming that some laws of the Western world don't apply, in the sense that when you're dealing with a specific, like I think in any country, when you're doing something in the public sector like that, where you host, you know, QA, deployment strategies, all that stuff probably interferes with like the quickest way to production, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have, there's all kinds of challenges with regards to like regulations within the country. So I'm not sure whether all country, I know under Obama's term, we got an office of the CTO for a while. But Afghanistan, because it was essentially the current government was basically created in 2001, they have some fairly modern ideas. Like there is an organization of the government that is specifically designed for building and hosting software applications. So like they are a player in our project, and in some ways a competitor, because we're kind of doing their job for them. But because the US government is paying for it, not the Afghan government, everybody thinks it's better to have us do it. But it's also kind of a political conflict, because it's a little bit of a, they know they ultimately have to manage what we do. So they're, you know, suspicious of things that we might, you know, specify. So we have to sort of navigate that. And I suspect that's probably would be the case in many other countries too. It's just, you know, the nature of international donor-based development work. So we kind of have to learn the law of Afghanistan, basically. I do right here. Like I have the criminal procedure code of the country. This is a translation. So like we have to know what Article 145 means in terms of how the software needs to manage an appeal, which is kind of fun for me a little bit. This is part of the reason I took this project, is for a while in college, I considered going to law school and getting into copyright law. I thought that would be a interesting field when I was in school, and I think it would have, but I had left school and got into so much software development, had so much fun doing it, I kind of forgot to ever go to law school. So,
it's also got to be interesting, you know, and I imagine this is what SpaceX and Tesla developers feel like, where you're not building a, you're building bespoke, custom fit, glove on a hand software. So you're not thinking, well, how do I abstract this flow so that it can be multi-tenanted and, you know, it's more like, hey, if in this particular case there's this exception, then good, we're just going to code it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's very, one of the things I've found really odd about this project is that in the past, I would have approached a lot of problems where it's like there's a buy or build discussion you always have. And it would come into like third-party libraries we would use. So for example, like calendar selection, we need to select a date and a time that the crime occurred. So we're using Vuetify, and there's some controls that do that. There's some NPM packages we could use. But Afghanistan has two legal languages, Dari and Pashto. Dari is kind of a variant of Farsi, which is spoken in Iran. But very few computer tools support Dari, and even fewer support Pashto. So we're kind of presented with this problem all the time where it's like, well, if we use that third-party thing, then we need to patch it with all these language tools. So we have made the choice a lot of times just to like, well, let's go look at the source code for that thing, understand how, like, fundamentally how they did it. Is it hard for us to build our own? And then build our own. And we've ended up with, I think at this point now, we have like 30 really low level controls. Like we have different kinds of text field editors, date fields that will switch the from the solar Islamic calendar to the Gregorian calendar back and forth, and like all these tools. And at the time, like as a CTO for a long time, every one of those I would have been on other projects just like, no, it's too much work to build our own. That, like, that would be stupid. But tooling these days has gotten so good that a lot of these things are like 4 or 5 days of effort initially, couple days of debugging, couple weeks down the road, and then they become this massive resource that solves all kinds of problems throughout the project. And we're not kind of, we don't have developer communication problems about, oh, when you're dealing with this kind of date, you do this, and this is, you don't have to deal with those in policy anymore because the code is solving the problem for you. And I'm looking back and going, man, I bet there's a lot of places in the past where telling somebody, you know, I know it looks hard to build your own thing of that, but it's only going to take a day, so go ahead and do it. I think I would have. I think probably, and this is back to the degeneracy thing, we have this mentality of dry that's like, well, somebody else already built some component, so don't, you know, don't repeat that work, right? So reuse whatever you can reuse. The problem is you've increased complexity because now you have a dependency on some third-party control that in turn might have other dependencies, and you don't really know what that looks like. And if you're talking about a day of work to build it the first time, you're probably talking about a day of work to rebuild it if you did it wrong. And so you have this known quantifiable impact of how hard that's going to be. And I think just looking back, was always in so much of a hurry to say, oh, well, this one takes 5 minutes, this one takes 8 hours, let's definitely go with the 5 minutes choice, and not really thinking through the second order impacts of, well, how's that going to affect how easy it is for us to upgrade to the next project. And that's kind of a side effect on this project. We've known from the beginning that we have to hand this off to this agency I was talking about. And so we've wanted to like really tightly control, like we don't want a mess at the end. We want to know, okay, we're using this dependency and this is why. When it needs to be upgraded, this is how you do it. So every time we do, so we're using Vue.js on the project, and Vue 3 was just released. So we know we're going to upgrade, but we know we're not going to upgrade until we have the time to really closely document, okay, we ran into this problem, this is how we addressed it, this is the steps we took to upgrade, so that when Vue 4 comes out, that documentation is there and ready to say, okay, this is where you're likely to run into problems, and this is what we did to solve them. So it's that approach has made us really, really avoid dependencies because we know we have to document them. And
because and this is what I I always scratch my head with this, but when I talk to founders, especially founders who want to pause development, I always tell them, well, it's the thing, your code is going to age. And it's not because it gets crusty on the disk drive because no one's loading it. It's because all the thousands of dependencies that we used to build this, that's not standing still. So there are the dependency monster is the thing that is stays very much alive. And a lot of our debt, technical debt, a lot of our work is really to feed that monster because, yes, you had to make a simple fix, but when you tried to compile the code, it was the other package that you were including is now a version later. And now you now, and then when you start freezing those versions and you're starting to depend on, well, now you're just kicking the can down the road because...
Yeah, it's an unwinnable battle. I think this goes back to that right brain thing. Like you want this, like the freezing dependencies thing is this need for certainty. Like, oh, I have control over my deployment. Docker is the same thing. Like immutable builds, right? We want that because they're controlled. They are controlled, but the world is not. So like you may have a perfectly built Docker container in 5 years that has an embedded dependency of some massive security hole that is still an open security hole inside that Docker container. And that it is not really immutable if you start considering its interactions in the real world. So you can't really ever cordon off something and push pause on it. Like the world keeps moving on. And especially, I think this is so true for startups too, because startups, the world moves faster for startups than the rest of society. And that's like, that can be a benefit because it can be, you're used to switching, pivoting more often, but it can also be like this, like you see it as your main problem to solve. How do we control our code quality? How do we build this right? And I think a lot of the startups I've worked with in retrospect, I would have actually been sloppier and built things, you know, messier and just been more eager to like throw it away and said, yeah, we have this shitty system that's got all of this mess in it. And it's like, you know, a Frankenstein's monster, but you know, I'm going to bet Facebook has some really shitty PHP code running in it.
I was about to say, you just characterized thousands of startups who are built on PHP and then have the first Ruby on Rails conversation. I can't tell you how many conversations I was in where I had to tell my developers that shitty PHP code is paying your salary. So I wonder, so in considering that fast pace of startups, considering the 5 minutes versus 5 days approach, do you think that the artificial urgency, the artificially urgent system that is on top of what nature really wants to be, is our economics system, where it's got to be done cheaper, you can't spend the extra $10. You know, is it because we have the scarcity mentality? You could invest the $5,000 to do it a certain way, but you'd rather spend $50 because $4,950 can go towards an extra Google ad spend.
I mean, I think the short answer to that is context, back to the left brain, right brain thing, right? The right brain is always aware of the context. So I think the thing that we miss in startups, when you focus on the speed of things, you miss the context of like what actually matters and why, and being more into, I think I talked about this on our podcast before, that book Adapt, which he talks about the Palchinsky principles, which is the third one has to do with making sure you're aware of the experiments you're making, basically being in harmony with the world. So when I'm talking about the 5 minutes versus the 5 days, there are some situations where, like, oh, what we're talking about is some one-off corner of the system that, like, oh, this customer, this salesman, one salesperson thinks this is a good idea, and we want to run an experiment on this particular approach, and we want to experiment with the code in some way, and this third-party component, we can plug it in 5 minutes, and it will let us do that, but it will create mess. You can kind of take that context and say, okay, that might be a place where a really terribly built experiment that we hardly even test it might be fine. But if what you're talking about is like the literal, you know, it's page one of your investor deck, and it's the technology that your whole system is built on, like, build it yourself. Like, that's, you know, that's going to be a long-term component, and you know how it's going to work, and you want to own it and make sure it works well. So I don't think you can answer that, you know, with a rule. I think you have to take the context into account and say, okay, this is an important tool. I think bring it back to the example in Afghanistan, like, this system is used by the US government in the context of peace negotiations and all kinds of other, you know, English speaking, like, other English speaking international donors are going to use the system. So it needs to work well in English, but it's fundamentally going to be used 90% of the time in Dari and Pashto. So having really good tools to translate English, Dari, and Pashto and make that process seamless is worth the investment. And so we have invested a lot of time in custom components and avoided third-party tools. Like, I think we even started to implement our own solar calendar conversion function for a while because whatever we were using was problematic. And so, like, those are worth that effort. But things that we might do for a demo, we might build really sloppily and, you know, just build quickly to get out the door.
Yeah, I love that emphasis on context as one is marrying degeneracy with unnatural optimization and straight lines, because I think that in our roles as CTO, we need to put ourselves in a position where context is presented, context is understood, context is promoted. And as someone then who understands the technology components, the business direction, the long-term value, to then be able to say, well, given that, this is a 5-minute task and should be one, and we should go find the package, and we shouldn't be building this. Versus the 5-day task, which is, this is so critically important to us that I know you think that it shouldn't cost us $50,000 to build this, but now it's my job to say, well, this is why the 50 grand is an essential spend on this task.
Yeah, I think I got asked in an interview, the interview that I almost accepted before starting this project, the person asked me, what's your management philosophy? And that's one of those questions that, like, you should have an answer for. Like, that's, a lot of people ask that, and there are, like, known management philosophies. And I was, like, completely unprepared for the question. I'd never thought about that before. What's my management philosophy? But what came out of my mouth was empathy and context. And I explained, I was like, I think I have two jobs as a manager of a team. Two jobs. One is to make sure the team is aware of the context in which they're operating. Like, they need to understand not just the CEO asked for X, like, the task is X, but they need to understand the CEO's motivations, the business's vision, like, what's going on, what the market opportunity is, and why we're, like, what we're doing, because the CEO might ask for something stupid. And when they realize, oh, that's a stupid request with technically speaking, and we can solve the business vision better with task Y, the team kind of needs to be empowered to understand that. And they can't do that unless you have told them, communicated to them what the context is. And then the other piece, empathy, is I think like what I explained in the interview is like, well, I've been a CEO type person. I've been a developer with a crazy CEO and I've been a manager. So I've been in all these environments. I know what it's like to be there. And it's like, I know what a death march is like and how to avoid it and have empathy. But I also know what it's like to be in a position where the developers just can't work fast enough and you can't, you know, you can't satisfy the investors because you're not moving fast enough. And so understanding both of those things and communicating between them, I think is what like my approach to management kind of is. And I think the interviewer was kind of like, was really taken aback by the context piece that was like, well, that's not a management philosophy. But I think for me, it is. It's like, that's your whole job is to make sure people understand what the vision is. You know, a higher level of leadership, you have to set the vision too. But I think as a manager, most of the time, it's your job is to just make the team aware.
I think the empathy part also drives that need to provide context, because you want to bring the best out in people. And so if you're post-industrial age, where it's the knowledge age and it's knowledge workers, and you need to be able to know when people need to know certain things because you want to unlock certain gifts, skills.
Yeah, being aware of why your team is there. Like why does your senior engineer want to work on this team? Why does, you know, the intern that just started, why did they pick your company? Like understanding those things to know what they're trying to get out of it, because it's a two-way market. Like you're trying to satisfy some customer, but you're also like, you know, people have a choice in how they spend their time, and you know, they don't check their brain in at the door and let you use it from 9 to 5 and then check it out.
Which is often not only how they are managed, but how they view themselves. And I mean, I struggle with that to this day. It's like, am I providing value if I just think about something?
Thanks again for joining us here in the CTO studio. Thank you to our guest, Aaron Longwell. If you would please go check out Mr. Longwell's LinkedIn. Also, do go check out 7ctos.com and subscribe to this podcast here, available in iTunes. As always, we will see you again next time.